Folks, thanks very much. I'm Tom Hivester, an alcoholic. I'm delighted to see you. I'm a member of the primary purpose group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina. I noticed that Jesse is a DCM for, District 78? 7B. 7B. I'm the alternate DCM for District 52. Now, all that means is that I'm just the least little incident away from sitting at the big table with Jesse and those other guys. My sobriety date is February 2nd of 57, and I'm just wrong. Now, all that means is that they have to put me on early because I may not make it all the way through. I'm really glad to be here. Good to be back in Georgia. I'm always glad to come down to Georgia. Good to be at the Georgia prepaid state convention. Somehow that just has an odd ring to it, that a group of alcoholics are going to prepay anything. I've heard of our principle of self-support, but my God, that's almost perfect when we get into prepaying something. I'm really proud of you. I think that says an awful lot about the quality and integrity of AA in Georgia, and so I'm just really delighted to see that. It really is good to be back in Macon, too. This is a nice town. And what Jim said is exactly right. Johnny and I were talking about, it so happens, in case you're not aware, that Macon has the greatest number of registered historic sites east of the Mississippi River. And I just found that one day when there was an incredibly brilliant AA committee invited me in one day before the convention started. Checked in the hotel, wasn't nobody there but me. And I thought, my God, what is going on here, man? Have you had a mass drunk or something? And I'm the only cat in town. But that was serendipity. I had a chance to get around and visit and make it, and what a delightful place. So do it if you get a chance. I really am pleased to be down, pleased to have an opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. I don't know what causes one guy to get called on a lot and others not as much. I don't know what it is because stories are essentially the same. Circumstances are a little different. I'm just awfully grateful that the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I found something brand new, totally different. Didn't know it at the time, but over the years, it has increased in value. It has increased in absolute rewards every year that I've been here. And I'm absolutely thoroughly enjoying Alcoholics Anonymous today, and I want to share with you as much as I can about that. Jim was real brief with his opening remarks. We'll get us out of here in time to do, what'd you say was next? Dancing and karaoke. I can't wait. I'm going to get in on some of that. I think that's going to be wonderful stuff. So we'll get down there as quick as we can. Now, I want to tell you about drinking and puking and beautiful old grand old days of yesteryear. Now, I really would like to talk a lot of program stuff tonight if I can, but one of the key things that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous that I think sort of sets us apart is everything we do grows out of experience. If it doesn't grow out of experience, it just doesn't go anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, we're storytellers. That's what we do. We tell our stories. And we found that somehow or other there is something that's remarkably powerful that happens when one alcoholic opens up his heart, shares his life with another. And it has the ability to gain the trust and confidence of another one like nothing else the world has ever known. And that's essentially what we do every time that we meet. And if we don't, if we get too far off that, we'll find ourselves sort of talking to ourselves. So I want to share experience. I was thinking that there's all kinds of experience. You know, certainly history doesn't change. Insight about history changes a lot. And when I look back at my life, it's in some ways it just looks like a jumbled blur. when I look back, because mine was one, it looks to me like we seem to come in two basic varieties. One is the kind who just starts drinking and drinks with seeming control for long periods of time and then just loses it and goes off to deep end. That's a genuine alcoholic, no question in my mind. There's another kind of whom I think I was an early model. That's a basket case from day one. And that was me. I mean, I never was anybody who had peaks of success and all. Well, I had them, but they were fleeting. You can be doggone sure of that. And mine just sort of happened so quickly. When I look back at it, it looked like a blur. But when I look at it, there are some things that just sort of stand out. And I'm gonna kind of capture this a little bit and then maybe expand on it a little bit as we go along. When I look at that life and look back, what was it that was significant about it? Every speaker I ever hear says it in a way. And when I look back at my life, it looks to me like I was a guy who developed two totally distinct lives. One that occurred inside that nobody knew about, including me, and another, the one on the outside. And the one on the inside, I won't go into a whole bunch about it. I'm not a causation freak, nor am I the village idiot. I think causation is important. But I'm not somebody who likes to live in it too much. Suffice it to say that I was a guy, like everybody else, who was shaped by my early environment, my early experiences, so that I grew up with some kind of troubling characteristics. I grew up with an unusually high sense of anxiety that later grew on into fear, at times almost uncontrollable fear, but a nagging sense of anxiety. I grew up with a good sense of insecurity, a good sense of kind of rebelliousness and anger about, I don't know what, it was just a quality that developed. I developed a lot of a very important thing central to my alcoholism and certainly central to my recovery, a thing called isolation. You hear more and more about that these days, but isolation was something that was both cause and problem in my life to a significant degree. Well, those are not uncommon characteristics, I don't guess. I guess everybody has some of that. But I happened to develop some sort of coping mechanisms, I guess, ways to deal with those things, so that I could get through life without being paralyzed by those things. I developed some traits and characteristics. Now, in AA, we call them character defects. But they were things that I developed to help me cope and survive and get through this thing called life. And I refer to stuff like, if you looked at me in my drinking, you would have seen the polar opposite of what I'm describing. You wouldn't have seen a fearful, withdrawn type of guy when I was going through my paces. What you'd have seen was a loud guy who made a lot of noise. You'd have seen a guy who was the life of the party. You'd have seen a guy that was a kind of a reckless daredevil type of guy. I don't recall ever being challenged to do anything in my entire life that I didn't try to do. And so I looked like anything but what I was. But that was the way that I got through life, was by overcompensating and doing things. And I developed some real troubling characteristics, and we do call them character defects. For example, lying. Now, I never took any training in lying. I just developed a remarkable faculty for lying. I became an instinctive liar. In fact, I still am to some extent. I don't do it as much as I used to. In fact, try not to do it at all. But I'll promise you that I have never become instinctively honest. I don't know of a time in my life that I have ever blurted out the truth unexpectedly. I have to plan it. Now, I don't have to plan lying. I mean, even today, if I get into tight and I got to make up something real quick, it'll be a lie. I will not blurt out the truth. Now, that's a defect of character, a flaw in the way I dealt with life. Getting aggressive. Oh, well, anyway, a whole bunch of stuff. Well, that was a kind of an awkward kind of a deal where a guy is torn in two different kinds of lives. And I spent a little bit of time on that because That explains to me why booze had such an importance in my life. Because when I started to drink, what that stuff did was sort of pull the two sides together. You know, some people refer to booze as a social lubricant. I guess it is. That stuff greased me up, I'm telling you, big time. And I was about as socially slick as you could get. And it worked. It absolutely worked. That stuff did something magical for me. I loved it. I absolutely loved everything about it. Loved the trashy folks who did it with me. I loved the behavior that went on. Loved the places. I loved everything about booze. And so I started to drink for one simple reason. It made me feel wonderful. It freed me from the prison of my own life and worked extremely well. I hear a lot of people, I'm not one of them. A lot of people say they drank, but booze quit working for them. It never quit working for me. Booze is the only thing I ever found in my life that did exactly what I was looking for every single time that I went there. The only problem is it started overdoing what it did. And the solution became the problem. But if it hadn't become the problem, I guarantee you I'd be doing it now. Because that stuff really did something good for me. A lot of people marvel at why we don't stop drinking. The amazing thing to me would have been if I had stopped drinking. I never could think of any good reason. Never saw anybody who didn't drink that I cared anything about being like. Everybody I ever saw who didn't drink looked like they didn't drink. It just looked mad. It just never occurred to me it would be a nice thing to do. And so I just sort of took off, went wild with that stuff, and I never would have stopped, except for one simple thing. I developed alcoholism. I don't know why. I'm not overly curious about why. I just know that it happens. We describe it a lot of different ways. Nobody ever really defines it, but we describe it a lot of ways. We refer to it as crossing a line, that it's almost as if that I went headlong through life, crashing, running, having a ball, overdoing it a little on a regular basis, but loving what I was doing. And then it was almost as if the curtain fell on Act 1 and Act 2 started. Now, it certainly wasn't that kind of quick, dramatic thing. The change was so subtle, I didn't even know it occurred till I got sober and looked back. But something happened, no matter what it was. We refer to it as losing the ability to control our drinking. Something happened with me that apparently doesn't happen with most people who drink, but happened with this guy. So that if I took a drink, I couldn't predict my behavior. I couldn't predict what I would do. Couldn't predict how much I would drink. And so from the time that started, I didn't particularly drink more, but I drank with different results, more unpredictable results. And my life became a rather bizarre pattern of just waking up in kind of strange circumstances and strange places. And baffling, to say the very least. I had some extremely poor sleeping habits. I wasn't particularly choosy about where I slept. And some people objected to it. It often had kind of bad side effects. I woke up once. I mean, I just woke up sleeping in the middle of a U.S. highway. Yeah, I guess I thought those yellow lines were the bed or something. I don't know what I thought. I didn't think anything. I just laid down probably and fell. Not nice. Woke up one time, came to, fighting with two guys. Trying to fight. I was doing all right, except I couldn't stand up. And every time I tried to swing, I'd go down, and they didn't even hit me. Turned out those two guys were two folks who walk in front of a switch engine. I don't know if they still do this or not, but when they make up a train in a yard, they have somebody walking in front of the engine that throws a big old switch, and the train switches over and so forth. Those two guys were walking in front of an engine and found me literally draped across the two rails, feet across one and head across the other. And they were trying to get me off. And I thought there was somebody trying to throw me out of a joint or something, and we were duking it out. That was that kind of a guy. I just developed that pattern of waking up in strange circumstances. In jails became a routine. I don't know how many times I've been in jail. I like to think I've been in the exact right number of times. Psych wards, you know, my behavior looked peculiar. I thought it was pretty nice, but most people thought it was peculiar. They'd put me in psych wards, hospital, with stuff broke. I didn't even know I'd been injured. And that kind of stuff. And I'll tell you this, I don't know if others are like this or not. I rarely hear anybody say this, but I never, until I was sober in AA, for a good while, I never connected the first drink with what ultimately happened. I never connected the problems with the first drink. And every time I would wake up in some jackpot or other, and I'd take a look around at the most recent wreckage of the past, my response would be the same: you've done it again. You're no good. You're irresponsible. You have no discipline. You have no character. And that is exactly what I believed. And every time I would go through that moral whipping, you know, I really believe the issue was that I simply was no good. It's an interesting thing to me and telling to me that, you know, you hear the word denial a great deal in our society. It's applied to almost every human condition. Rare television program that doesn't have something about it on there. You hear it a lot in AA meetings. I'll tell you one place that you don't see it is in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that you don't see it not because Bill didn't think of the word. My God, as wordy as he was, he would have certainly thought of the word. I don't think he used the word because I think it's too lightweight for the condition. Because what I was experiencing then was not denial. Hear what I said. Although I repeated those bizarre kinds of behaviors over and over and over, I never saw them till I was sober for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't mean I ignored them or argued or minimized them. I didn't see those things until I was sober. Now, our book refers to illusion and delusion, which is a way different thing. It refers to it as an inability to differentiate the true from the false. Now, that describes what was going on with me. And so that was what my life became. Now, I developed alcoholism, and that's the way it went. And my life was just a zoo gone wild, man. It happened so quickly that it really did. I was in past the point of no return almost before I even knew I was in trouble. And I started serious drinking at 16, had what I hope and pray was my last drink 8 years later, 8 short years later, at the age of 24. You know, I will assure you that people who drink like me don't become old drunks. I just don't believe that they would make an old drunk. And I never believed I would make an old drunk. I just went to hell in a handbasket in a hurry. And it, you know, I was a guy that, I'll just say this, I was not just a total loss. I did have some moments of brilliance, really. We use a word lightly here sometimes that I'm not so sure doesn't have great utility here, that alcoholics do seem to have an unusual amount of potential, of ability that is often lost in the drunkenness. And I think I was certainly a case of that. I was a guy that had an uncanny ability to be overestimated. Most everybody who ever looked at me in any determining kind of way overrated me. I was the kind of guy that would go looking for a job and people would hire me for a better job than I was looking for. When I looked good, I looked real good. I had an opportunity to be selected. I'll give you a couple of examples. I went in the military, just a doofus kid from North Carolina, never been anywhere. And out of 1,000 men, they picked me out, along with 4 other guys, to be developed as officers, to become leaders of men and stuff like that. Now, when they picked me out, I knew that was a bad mistake. A little while later, they knew that was a very bad mistake. Without training how to fire a weapon one day, and they had to stop me. I was about to shoot the fella in charge of the shooting. I mean, I wasn't mad at him. I was just pointing the wrong way. they caught on that I was not quite leadership material at that point. But that's a good start, eh? The year, 38 months later, I was thrown out with an undesirable discharge for alcoholism. The same year that I was thrown out, I was named Salesman of the Year for my organization in Charlotte, our largest city. Fired the same year. An amazing ability to do well, an even more amazing ability to totally wreck anything that came. And so that was my life. It was these beginnings and failures, beginnings and failures. And I finally wound up in short order, living a kind of life that I swear to God I didn't even know existed. I came from a little old Mayberry-looking town up in North Carolina, and we had to hire a town drunk. No, we had one. We had one guy. And us kids used to kind of enjoy him. He was the only fun in town, and he'd get DT'd. We'd follow him around like a circus act. But he was all we had, you know. And so we didn't have a whole bunch of mafia or anything like that in that little old town. And then I wound up, after I got out of the military, I just drifted off wherever drunks congregated. That's where I went. And I wound up in the state of Michigan. And didn't mean to. That's just where we wound up. And wound up building Buick automobiles in the early 50s. I swear, I still feel bad about that. I can just imagine some guy driving down the highway and all at once the steering wheel comes up. It says, "What fool built this car?" You know. I didn't mean to, but I wasn't well at the time. But that's where it wound up. Then I worked up there until my reputation got from it. In a city of 500,000 people, I wound up unemployed and darn near unemployable. And in my last couple of years, the last year, almost full time, my primary address was one of three or four places, just the street itself or the local jail. I went to jail so regularly they thought I worked there. There was a theater there that I think ran the same movies over and over. It didn't make any difference. Nobody watched it anyway. And, just whatever haven I could get with somebody. During that period, I used to say that I lived by my wits, but that isn't exactly the right characterization for the way I live. I live by my lack of character. And I tell you this, I'm not proud of this by any stretch of the imagination. I'm no desperado. I'm no gangster. I'm not a predatory criminal. I'm an alcoholic who just lost the ability to function. And I lived during that period of my life the way people lived in that piece of life. And what I looked at, I'm sure that somebody would have called it criminal behavior, but it was the food chain where I lived. I mean, it was just the way it worked. You know, one day the other guy was friskier and he had drank, the next day I was, and that's just the way it was. I never thought I would come to the point that I would be rolling drunks, taking from other people, using, abusing everybody that I knew, hustling, bumming, God, whatever. Selling my blood $5 a throw. And I'm talking about a young fella in his 20s. And I never believed I would ever come to such a place. And I'm confident, absolutely no question whatsoever, that I would have drunk myself to death real quick. But I was brought to a stop. Many of you are well aware. I was brought to a stop, unfortunately, not soon enough and not solidly enough. I'll just say this. I won't get overly heavy with it, but I'll just say this. I welcome a lot of people into Alcoholics Anonymous. I never say this to them, but I welcome, well, once in a while I do. But I welcome many, many people who are in here because they got another DWI or something. And every time I ever meet somebody who's moaning the blues about one more DWI, to myself always and to them sometimes, I say I would give anything on God's green earth if I'd gotten one more. One more. Anything to stop. Because I wound up doing the kind of thing that I know every alcoholic in this world is feared doing. Thank God most don't. But I wound up taking human life. I woke up in jail one morning. No novelty there. That was a routine occurrence. And after the wake for a while, jailer came by, knew him well, asked him when I could get out, and he said, "I hope never." He walked off. And I had no clue what he was talking about. And then some of the other guys in there told me the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city and had run over and killed two people. And my reaction, I guess, was like any human would be that's got any sense of right and wrong at all. It's just shock and disbelief, and I could not handle the information. I mean, I knew I was capable of anything, but I never believed anything like that, just like anybody, never believed it would happen. And gradually accept the truth. The only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. And then somebody contacted my folks. They learned that I had family. I didn't tell them. They learned that I had family in North Carolina, and my mother and sister came up and negotiated my release on bond, charged with manslaughter. And I didn't know how to say I was afraid to get out of that place. I was ashamed to face anybody. I couldn't face anybody. And I knew without any question that I would never drink again. Who could? I mean, my God, how could you ever drink again after something like that? You don't ponder the question if you're an alcoholic, you know. Now I know that was the most unlikely time that I would have ever not drunk. And of course I did. I stayed sober a day and a half walking the streets and then started to drink. And from July to November of 56, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. I mean that. No, not any boastful comparison. It's just a flat fact. I've worked with many, many thousands of alcoholics over the years. I've never worked with one like me. And I was just a guy obviously trying to drink himself to death. And then November the 19th of 56, coming up pretty quick, I hope and pray will be the date of my last drink. It's the date of my last drink so far. That morning I finished a bottle of gin, had about that much in it, went to court, knew that it was a one-way trip. I knew I wouldn't be back. I had no defense. I mean, what do you say? I mean, the hell of blackouts is you just don't know. And anybody could have told me I had done anything, and I would have had no defense. At this time, the charges were very specific, and I understood that I had indeed done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. And so when my trial came up, and I walked in that morning, my attorney said to stand mute. I'd never heard of such a plea, but to stand mute. And I thought later, what a perfect plea to enter. I mean, what do you say when you're not even witness to your own behavior? And so I was found guilty, of course, sentenced that day to 5 to 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, I was a character. I was not a hothouse flower. But neither was I somebody. I'd never been to a major league institution. I'd been to jails and county farms and peat farms and stockades and stuff like that. I'd never been to a show enough penitentiary, and I knew I was going to a show enough penitentiary. I was going to Jackson. It still stands. I visited every once in a while. And the day I walked in there were 6,000 people locked up in that place on November the 20th, 56. I use the term rather loosely. They were all people, but some of them were some of the finest folks that I've ever met in my life. Some are my dear friends today. Some were the scurviest excuses for humans that I've ever seen. A liberal sprinkling of both. And I walked in, resigned to my fate, never believed I would ever come out of there alive, and honest to God, did not care. Just didn't care. And it wasn't cynicism or bitterness or anything like that. I just wanted to be gone. I just wanted to disappear. My first period in there was you talk about isolation, a condition of isolation. Man, that thing snapped back in on me after those events and then getting sober and being locked in that place. I was as isolated as any human I've ever met. I didn't engage in any conversation with anybody about anything unless he asked me a direct question. One day a guy called me out for an interview and asked me a direct question. And among many, asked me about my drinking. He had my history in front of him, and it was obvious that I had some experience with that. And when he got through with his interview, he made the same diagnosis that everybody who ever talked with me made. It was always something like, you sure drink a lot, or you drink too much, or you're drunk, or you're an alcoholic, or what have you. Those things never had any real impact on me. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I'd been drunk all my life, but I did not believe I was an alcoholic. Who could be an alcoholic at that? I'm 24 years old. Nobody could be an alcoholic at that point. I really believe that deep down I was basically a pretty good guy who just never quite got it together. But one of these days, man, look out, is really what I believed. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. He said that. And then he said something I'd never heard before. I'd had a lot of people tell me I was an alcoholic. But nobody else had ever suggested what you do about that other than, you know, stop drinking or cut down or what have you. This guy said, we have an AA group here at the institution. Was just the way he put it. And said, I think you ought to go. Now, it was just a conversational kind of thing. It didn't capture me or, harness me up to go over there or anything. Just an observation. And I don't even recall if we had any more conversation or not, but the 2nd of February of 57, I walked into my first meeting. I didn't particularly want to join AA. I think the only reason that I went in, the best I can tell, is that I just didn't have any resistance left. I just couldn't even muster resistance. And I think I would have walked into anything they said. If they had said, the gas chamber, here, walk right in, I would have walked right in. Anything they said, I was so beaten at that point. And I walked into that first meeting without a clue what to expect, not much as you were, I imagine, in your first one. Some of it was about what I expected. They prayed, same thing we prayed here. I was not a spiritual person and had not been for a long, long time. So I expected some praying. I just couldn't imagine doing anything to drunks without praying about it. Everybody I'd ever seen try to do anything with drunks and prayed about it. And I always bought whatever they were selling when they'd pray. And conversions would last probably 30 minutes or so. And it never did have any real meaning or really impact. And so they prayed. They read this stuff that we read here tonight. Same identical thing. And I thought that was poetry or something. I didn't know that's what you did. I didn't have a clue what that was. And then they introduced the speaker. And the guy who spoke at my first meeting, he made an enormous impression on me. I thought the guy was Looney Tunes, to say the least. I could not imagine what a grown man would be standing up in front of 300 convicts telling some god-awful story like he was telling. It made no sense to me. I thought, Jesus, there is something wrong with this guy. And he told stories I wouldn't have told anybody, the drunkest I'd ever been. I kept thinking somebody going to come in with handcuffs any minute and put them on this guy. I'll give you just one quick example. He had been in that prison at one time himself and been out a long time. When he was in there, he had a job. The warden's office was in a big old building that was round like this. I was going to ask Jim where that corner was that the tapes are in. How do you get a corner in a round building? Alcoholics stew about one amazing things. We'll all analyze that when we get through, see where that tape is. But his job was working in that big round thing, and the warden's office was up on the second floor, and he rode an elevator to work. So he'd come in and ride the elevator. My guy that spoke at my first meeting and became my first sponsor got this brilliant idea that if he put a moonshine stand on top of that elevator, nobody would smell the thing because the fumes would go right out the top. So he did. And he said every time the warden went to work, he stirred it up for him. With that elevator. The whole time he was in, he ran that thing, never got caught. And I'm sitting there listening. I said, man, they're going to come get him. I don't know. So he didn't impress me as a living example of what I wanted to become. It was as different from me as anything I ever saw before or since. I didn't identify with anything about it. The amazing thing is that I was back the next week. Now, what for? I couldn't have told anybody. I didn't have to tell anybody. I just found myself back there the next week. I really believe that what brought me back was, you know how a magnet pulls at you? You know how a magnet will pull? I really think that what brought me back was that this guy was so turned on with life, so enthusiastic about life, so charged up, that that spirit that he conveyed is what pulled me back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no other reason. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I wasn't sure I ever wanted to stop drinking in my life. I knew without any question that I was far too worthless for any decent effort from any human. You know, my challenge at that point was not to try to develop a desire to stop living. My challenge was to try to develop a desire to live, period. And so every meeting that I went to, it was not only the feeling awkward about not fitting because of my outlook, it was the thing of being so worthless that I was ashamed to even be there. And so when I look at that and look at the fact that something happened that constituted a life-changing process, I can't help but be impressed by what happened. And I'll share with you just a little bit of what happened that I think, well, I've already described. You know, I think everything I've described is a part of what happened. Certainly that little guy who had the first person I ever met who said, "Hey, guy, there's a place for people like you. It's right over there." Isn't it interesting? The first invitation I ever heard, I took and have never looked back. Isn't that something? Now, he didn't heal me, but my God, how many people deal with alcoholics and don't have a clue how to tell them where to go find help? Thank God I found one who did. And so when I look at what happened, that certainly was part of it. That guy who spoke at my first meeting and became my first sponsor was part of it. But when I look at what happened to turn it around, you know, John and I were talking a little bit about that. A big, big part of why I'm sober today and why I'm shaped as I am in Alcoholics Anonymous had to do with that first group that I went into. It was called the Recovery Group at Jackson Prison. It's a maximum custody penitentiary. I stayed in maximum custody the entire time I was in there. Never got out. And that group was as fine an AA group as I've ever seen. I belong to a killer group right now. But it is no better than the first one I walked into in a maximum custody institution. Thank God for that. Thank God it wasn't some little lightweight gathering of just sort of yakking about nothing. That it was a good, purposeful group of alcoholics who set about the business of trying to learn the program of recovery. I'll be ever grateful for that. That group was a group. It wasn't just a casual gathering. It's really significant to me. When I think back about that and its importance in my recovery, that group constituted the first group of people I ever had confidence in my entire life. Now, I'm a great believer in purposeful groups. I'm a great believer in solid groups because that's the first place that I ever felt trust. These were a group of people who did exactly what they said they were going to do, no more, no less. They never failed to do what they said. I was not somebody who believed what people said. I believed in what people did. And that's the first place that I ever encountered and invested trust in people. Isn't that strange that 300 convicts meeting in a group of Alcoholics Anonymous would be that place? It's where I've developed my... I won't say much about it, not that I wouldn't want to, but I just won't take time. It's where I developed my very strong belief that you know, I'm somebody who believes in a balanced approach in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm a great believer in closed meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, an environment where alcoholics talk to alcoholics. How critically important for an illness of the magnitude of this one that there be a place where I can have confidence and trust in another human being. And the only place I ever had that was with another alcoholic in those feeble beginning days. I remember the first time that I ever said and meant it in a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, "You know, I am an alcoholic," and meant it. I really expected somebody to react and say, "Oh, no, not a nice fellow like you. You couldn't be. You're too young. You're too smart." Nothing happened. except that I found it was okay to open up and trust somebody else, a closed meeting. I'm a great believer in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as well, just like this one. I think it was great that we had that mayor here tonight. Even though he thought we were an anti-aircraft artillery battalion and that we were good at whatever it is that we do, that sounded very much like one of us explaining what we do. I think it was great that he was here. And what that implies in terms of being a good friend of this program. And he said, like anybody's going to say, you know, I got a couple of them hid in my back room too. Who doesn't? Who doesn't? So I believe in open meetings for that purpose. I believe in them for the family value of those things. I believe that alcoholism does not occur in isolation, that it is a family illness and recovery is a family process. If it isn't, it's going to be a very warped and narrow kind of recovery. So I believe in open meetings for that purpose. I believe it's important for me to give my undivided attention to somebody else for an hour and listen to somebody else's victories and defeats, cry with them, rejoice with them. Very important for me to learn to pay attention to somebody else and not just be thinking about me all the time. A tremendously important part of this thing. And so that kind of value develops, strangely enough, in a maximum custody institution. And I'll always be grateful for that group. That bunch of guys are the ones who helped me understand that Alcoholics Anonymous is a design for living. A very logical, a very practical design for living. Certainly it's a spiritual process, but it's also a very logical process, a design for living. I've been I'm retired now, but I've been a manager for at least 35 years. And my entire life and my professional life was made up of plans and designs and developments and goal setting and research and evaluation. That's my whole life. I have never seen a more logical, well-developed plan for managing than what's laid out in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it a design for living. The amazing thing about it is that there are no real qualifiers. What I was told and what I found to be true is that if I take the actions that are laid out in this plan for living, the results will happen. It doesn't say anything about my motives, sincerity, or anything like that. If I will take the actions, things will happen. And I believe, because I found it to be true, that the behavior is the parent of the feeling. Well, we don't say it that way. We say, what is it? We act our way into sober thinking. We don't think our way into sober living. Whatever. You know what I'm talking about. Thank God for that, because that's where I got that. And that was an excellent place where I learned what being a functioning member of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. So I'll always be grateful for that. I tell you, I'm somebody who believes, and true to form, I'm going to have to rush a little. But you remember we started at 8:31. Somewhere close. I'm somebody, I just sort of lay this out and you can track it with me. I'm somebody who believes, I really believe that alcoholism is a killer illness. And the more I work with people, God knows, the more I'm convinced of the deadly nature of this illness. I swear to God, I don't know. Well, I understand it's the illness that does it, but it is the most devastating thing to watch what happens to somebody who's been sober for even extended periods of time, who sort of lose that spirit. And I don't know what it is. The change of mind, give up, disappointed. I don't know what. Just stop doing things. And to watch the change come. And to watch this illness take over somebody's life again. And be almost powerless to intervene in that thing. It's a powerful, powerful illness. And it's not one, I kind of like what old Silkworth says in that book, I swear I barbecue everything I try to quote. But what it says to me is, that for something as serious as what we've got, frothy emotional appeal won't be enough. What does he mean, frothy emotional appeal? With all due respect to what we're doing here tonight, this is frothy emotional appeal. This is a celebration. What we're doing here tonight is celebrating what we have found together. And we're enjoying fellowship. We're enriching our families. We're enriching our lives. But this is not the fundamental thing of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an expression of that. Frothy emotional appeal. I feel good. My God, I would never drink. Fellowship itself. Frothy emotional appeal. You know, I thank God I drove this weekend. I can't believe it. I forgot how far it was to Macon. I was kind of weird, but I am also thankful to not be flying for 1 week. And that felt good, just riding down the highway. Nobody searched me all day long. But normally when I'm flying by myself in terms of the fellowship. And I'll assure you that feelings won't cut it. You got to have something that's strong, because I've been tested to the max in that setting. And this is an illness that'll take me out in a heartbeat if I'm not solid. So let me tell you about where that came into my life, where it started to really solidify and mean something. Now, I was, you know, academically or intellectually, I had read the book. I've always been a reader. I read the stuff, and I'd talked with the guys about it. I understood a lot about the words and all that. But I'll tell you that there's a major thing about critical turning points where something momentous happens. You know, that first period that I was in AA, I was an avid student in a way, but I was a very defensive student. I wasn't buying anything. I was just sort of playing with the words and grudgingly agreeing with some stuff. And then a turning point came. Went to a meeting one day, and I rarely talk about my story without talking about this, because it truly was a turning point. Speaker spent the entire meeting talking about the inventory step, the fourth step, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of herself. And when he finished it, he explained all about the red part of it, explained the importance of writing it, went back to my cell afterward. I said, okay, I'm going to do that. Now, I'd been sort of thinking about how such a nice fellow as me got in such a mess. And what I meant to do was not write an analysis of myself. I didn't mean to write an inventory. Well, I meant to call it that, but it wasn't going to look like an inventory. What I meant to write was a little story about how cruel life was and what a victim of circumstances I was, and that I really wasn't that kind of guy. That's what I meant to do. In my mind, though, I'll tell you what I'd figured out was, this is a heart-wrenching story. You may want to get your Kleenex ready. My family didn't break up. My father deserted the family when I was 4 years old. And I'll tell you, I don't care how much you want to write that off and cowboy with it, a four-year-old kid whose father walks off doesn't take that uninjured. That creates some real stuff. Well, now, that was never troubling to me in my entire life until I was sober about 15 years and started to realize I had to deal with it. So I effectively wrote it off, but I'll guarantee you, like most real defects of character, they go very deep. And so him leaving was certainly significant, but it wasn't nearly as bad as what happened next. She found another one. And she brought this little guy, and I don't mean to offend anybody at all. God knows I didn't come here to do that. But he was what you might call vertically impaired a little bit. He was a runt, what he was. Little old short dude. And, I mean, nothing wrong with that. If he'd have been a nice guy, I wouldn't have even noticed it, probably. But he was a pure turkey. I swear to God, man, that guy was a slug of a human being. And I hated that dude the day he drove up. I was just a little old guy, 6 years old. And I was small enough that I had to call that thing Daddy. And, Jesus, every time I'd call him Daddy, I'd just feel my blood pressure. I'm talking a little boy, and I'd just get mad. God, that ain't my Daddy. And it got worse. It didn't get better. I mean, I slammed, didn't like that guy. I I swore if I ever got big enough, I was going to whip him big time. And then I went off to the Army, came back. I was too big. I never did get to whip the old fool. He died, and and I'll tell you, I don't even like him dead. I really don't. I don't like that boy. Best thing that ever happened to him, he buried him up in South Carolina. Now, to the untrained eye, that sounds a little like a resentment, I imagine, but... Whatever it is, I ain't going to fix it. Well, I mean, that's what I thought. Anybody grew up with that kind of pervert stuff would have to be a little weird, and I was. Now, that's what I meant. That made sense as long as I was just thinking about it. But my God, when I started to write that garbage, founders were wise when they said to write. I wrote about two lines of what I had in mind, then with no intent whatsoever. I swear to you, this is exactly the way it happened. It was all at once. I don't know, I guess I just saw the sham and the farcical nature of that just total blank of what my life was. All at once, I saw it and the charade was over. And I stopped, and in one motion, without any intent or preparation whatsoever, I just opened up, and it wasn't a thoughtful inventory in terms of columns and all that. All it was a tortured young fellow pouring out his heart, that's all. And some people call that a cathartic experience, I guess. I just sort of poured out what was there. And my hand raced trying to keep up with the tumble of thoughts. And when I got through, I had three pages of pretty hopeless-looking scribble. Nobody could have read it. Nobody was supposed to read it. What that constituted was the finest day's work this old boy has ever done, bar none. Bar none. That day, something fundamental occurred in my life that has never been the same since. When I finished that, I knew without any question whatsoever I was alcoholic. I have never doubted it one second to this moment. Come close to drinking a few times, but never once with that goofy thinking, well, maybe you're not really alcoholic. No, I know I'm alcoholic. What happened to me that day is, it's a great line in our book where it's talking about it in more about alcoholism. It says something close to this, that we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. Easy sounding line, isn't it? Tremendously important. Now, when I started out, I told you I was Tom Iveser and I'm an alcoholic. That's not what that's about. That's conversation. That's communication. That's saying, you know, here's who I am. That's a very social level of that. Not what the step's talking about. Concede is a very private word. It's a very personal word. It's not a public word. Concede is an inside job. And what happened to me that day, I conceded at the core of my being that I'm a guy who cannot drink. I'm beat. Fought a good fight, but I lost. And I got knocked cold in a mackerel. And there is no fight now. It's over. That fight's over. And that's what concedes about. The other thing happened that day, I became a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't tell anybody that. Didn't have to. Didn't sign anything. Don't have to. But I have never gone to a meeting from that day to this without knowing 100% why I'm there. I'm a man with a purpose. I'm a man with a mission. I'm not here to perform or do a dog and pony show or to entertain or that. I'm an alcoholic whose purpose is to share this message with another. And every meeting I go has that purpose as the fundamental thing. And so it changed the character. I became a real functioning member. From that day to this, I have never been the lost face in a crowd. Not one single time. So that was a turning point, a major turning point. There's a whole bunch more that I'd like to talk about because that certainly doesn't cure, but it is a foundation that solidifies the work. And from then on are the things that don't mean much. They just sort of open up the door to freedom, and then they give the tools to become free. I'll just say this in a general kind of headline way. that I believe that even for a life that is with trouble with things like mine, no matter what the gravity of the amends, this program will be sufficient to help us get through those, to become free in those, and to become usefully whole in those. And I know that because that's exactly what my experience has been. I won't go into that. Anybody that's got trouble making grievous amends and you'd like to talk about it, I would be more than happy to talk with anybody that wants to, but I won't take the time to do that right now. So I just bundle it up this way. My belief is just mine, but it's surely mine, is that every time I used, abused, misused, hurt, injured people, what I did, I didn't win. I lost because I paid for that with a piece of my soul. And I will never be a free man till I go back and make right those wrongs and amend those warped and distorted relationships. And that's what this program gives us, are the tools to deal effectively with that. And so I'll just say that about that. I did those things to the every extent that I could while I was still in a maximum custody penitentiary. And if you don't believe it works, I tell you this, and you can go to the bank on it, I became a free man in a maximum custody penitentiary. In every sense of the word except physical, probably the least important, free man. This thing will work. I don't care who you are, where you are, what your circumstances. I hope you won't write this off and say, well, that's different. You better believe it's different. All it is life in the extreme. So I don't care what the circumstances are. These tools are adequate, and they'll do the job. They sure did for me. And when I got out, they finally let me go and on condition I go to North Carolina. I said, not stay in Michigan. They only kept me 3.5 years, and they told me they'd turn me loose if I'd go down there. So I went, and I hit the ground like millions of other folks who walked out. There might have been one key difference. I knew at the depth of my being that I would never go through that indignity again. I knew that I would never do that again. And what I meant by that was that I'm too tough to do it, I'm too smart to do it. That didn't even enter the picture. I meant that I would do whatever it took. And I knew that this program was my ticket to freedom. It's the only ticket I had. And so when I left, I had little dreams like anybody does. I wanted to be physically free. I wanted to be able to work and to make a living. I wanted to be a part of a community. I was thinking, one thing in particular about that, I was just thinking about that. Here we're sitting with the mayor and we're talking about things in a community that today have meaning to me, even in somebody else's community. You know, I wanted, and for me to be a citizen was a real dream. I'd never been a citizen. All I'd ever done was wreck towns. I never did build anything. I wanted to do that. Had a kind of a wistful hope that I might be trusted someday by somebody to do something that might be able to be of some use. Might even have a family. But I can tell you that dreams come true. There isn't a single little dream that I've had that hadn't come true in spades and then far beyond in many, many ways. I'm a fortunate guy in a way in that I was broken enough that I didn't have any bargaining power when I got here. I never knew what a blessing that was till I worked with people who had many resources to interfere with their surrender. And I was broken enough that what I did was just give this useless life to this simple program. And I'm telling you, fellow alcoholics, it gave me back a life beyond anything that I even dared dream. I mean, far beyond. And I won't have time to talk about it much. I just sort of lump it up this way, and that my life has certainly gone in directions I would not have planned. I've gone through doors I wouldn't have even knocked on. I'm not even sure I'd have walked on the same street. But all of the things, I hope I can say this right, everything of any real substance or value that's happened to me in my life happened without any overt activity on my part to make it happen. All of the truly significant things that happened came to me just as a result of what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and things come that I wouldn't have even asked for. Privilege to drive, getting to do volunteer work in a prison, doing service work, being accepted all over this country. Offered a position, the first ex-con in history, hired as a professional employee in a correction system, came my way, and I wouldn't have believed it. Had the opportunity to become a warden in a correction institution. And I guarantee you, that one never got on my dance card. I never really entertained that. And nobody else ever had either. I guarantee if you thought about that, you had to be smoking rope or something. That ain't no way. But I put in 20 years in that particular profession, and just last December finished up a 39-year career in corrections that I wouldn't have traded for anything in the world. It was a marvelous, marvelous experience. I tell you, if you really want to know how to retire and do it effectively, I'll be glad to do a little seminar for you. I retired in December, and I had already been elected chairman of the AA Correctional Facilities Committee to be effective on my retirement. So my retirement might have lasted one nanosecond or something. But I'm right back doing 100% what's the closest thing in my heart. I'm the area chairman for correctional facilities in North Carolina, and I am an extremely busy fellow in what I'm doing, but I love it very, very deeply. Yeah, I'm a guy that I just kind of wrap up with who I am and kind of ask you to join with me in this thing. Yeah, I'm a simple guy. I live in a little old town in North Carolina. I'm a guy that has some pretty strong commitments. I've got a family to whom I'm greatly committed, a community. I'm a member of a home group. I belong to a group, and I guarantee you nobody that knows me has any doubts about where I belong. I believe in home groups, not only for the welfare that it gives me, the help that it gives me, but because it's where I do my work. It's where I do my work. The way I look at it, that I'm no better member than the group that supports me. And if I don't have a group to deliver on what I promise to a new person, I'm false advertising. I'm also somebody who believes that a group is no better than the group next to it. I'm not somebody who gets into, I belong to the greatest group in the world. I belong to a good, strong group. But my group is no better than the group next door. It's autonomy, like we talk about it, doesn't mean isolation. Autonomy means freedom to be, but it doesn't mean freedom from. And so a part of what I have to look at, if I'm looking at the quality, integrity of my group, what kind of member am I, what kind of group are we to our neighboring group? So those are things that I have concern about. So when I look at where I am in my life right now, I guess really what where I am, I'm a guy that's been blessed enormously for coming up on 45 years. Been given a life and myriad experiences in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gained some experience. And I'm just one who simply can't take that off to the farm. I'm one who believes that I need to share that every way that I possibly can. That's why I'm an alternate DCM. The CCM is a guy I sponsor, and I want to help him be a real good DCM, and I can do it a lot better if I just kind of work alongside him instead of bossing him from afar. Yeah, I want to be a part of that thing. I want to contribute to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think what it boils down to is this with me. One, I want to be the best member I'm capable of being. Now, I don't mean I want to be the smartest guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I want to be well-informed enough that I can make good decisions. I don't want to pop off with some off-the-wall remark that I've been rattling for 30 years. I want to be in tune with the issues that come up and be well informed so that I can make good decisions in how I vote in our college tonight. When I vote for a GSR, I want to make sure that I vote for a GSR that's going to represent our group well. Because those are things I can do. So I want to be a well-informed member. I want to be involved strongly in my group. I want to be involved in organized service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that that's critically important. And for guys like me, I think it's critically important to be involved in it. A lot of things I worry about. But you can hurry up and believe I don't back off and throw rocks about it. I'm somebody who wants to work inside the tent. And I want to do everything I can to make Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess what it comes down to is this. I've got a mission, I hope you do. Personally imposed. That sort of characterizes what I want to do in AA. I want to be sure and do everything I can to make sure that the next man, woman, boy, or girl who comes into Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere for where that I am gets as good as I was given. Now that goes a way beyond just me and my personal magic. As good as I was given takes in a good, strong group, a good working fellowship. So I want to do everything I can to make sure that those conditions exist for the next person coming in. I give you one little piece of homework. You can take it or leave it. But I know that everybody gets aggravated about stuff in AA. If you don't, you just ain't making enough meetings. Because you're going to get aggravated. And this sounds a little bit cliche-ish, and it is. But let me tell you the way I like to attack problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the homework that I'd like to get you to take, if you will. If you aren't hearing in the meetings that you go to what you think ought to be heard at a meeting, if you don't hear sound solution stuff, if you hear stuff that you think romance is a problem instead of that, if you're not hearing what you want to hear, you say what you want to hear. Don't tell somebody else what to say. You say what you want to hear. And you're absolutely guaranteed to hear it. And when you do that, if your experience is anything like mine, you'll almost every single time notice the character of the conversation change. Another word for that is leadership. If you're not seeing the kind of behavior that you want to be seen in Alcoholics Anonymous, you do what you want to see. If you think Alcoholics Anonymous is becoming a kind of an unfriendly, cold place to be, if you think it ought to be a place where there are warm and friendly people who give a damn about a newcomer, you do that. You do that. You do that behavior and watch what happens. Those are just kind of simple little things, but they are what keep me from being a victim inside my fellowship. My job is not to straighten out the world. My job is to be the best, most effective member that I can be. When I came in here, somebody stuck out a hand and said, "Welcome to this chain reaction of love and service." That's the theme of this conference. The love and service is what we're about. Somebody stuck out a hand, I took it. A little later, somebody else stuck out his hand. The question for every one of us, we are a part of that chain called Alcoholics Anonymous. The only question is what kind of a link we're going to be in that. Strong one? I hope so. God forbid that I ever be selfish enough that I let it stop with me and don't pass on. Thanks a million, folks. Good to be with you.